Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week our guest will be Harav Yehuda David Bleich, the renowned Poisek and Mechaber Sfarim. He's Rashiva Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He's perhaps the greatest halachic medical ethicist in the United States. And back to back we will have from Meretz Yisrael, very different background, the Hasidisha, Gain, Rabbi Asher Weiss, the Baal Mechaber of the Minchas Asher, many halakim, also a great halachicist, and he is the Poisek and the Rav of Shari Tzedek Hospital, besides having a large koil and Mechaber of many Sfarim in Halacha, many Shalos of Tshuvas, etc., and he will be speaking about DNA in Halacha. He gets the paskin, where both from, parentage issues as well as, on Agunis, etc., but he's certainly besides medical ethics as the Paisik of a hospital, but science and current science, he has to, all the cutting new medical inventions, he's the first one on the scene with Halacha, and so he'll be speaking about using DNA in Halacha. I always like to throw in before we start, put in a little thought on the period we're going through right now. It's right before Sukkot, and Chazal say that Rizal actually says that Sukkot is called Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur is the time of Din, and Smolo Tachas L'Reishi, the left hand is always Din. The left hand just supports it, steadies it, doesn't do anything proactively, and the right hand is what actually embraces. So sukkah is considered a great embrace. There's the sukkah is spelled samach hafhei, and is a word from both the Gaon and the Chida. They say that there are three different types of sukkah. There is the four-walled sukkah, that is the samach. There is the chaf, the three-walled sukkah. And also you could have shnayim kilchasen v'shlishis afilu tefach. You could have the two-walled sukkah. And so it is in an embrace. You can give a beer hug where you smother the other person, or you can do a partial hug where, you just do a partial embrace, or you could just sort of grab a person around the back, which would be Shnaim, Kilchasen, Afilu Tefach. These are the three type of embraces, of beer hugs, forms of affection. So here's the question. Why is Sukkot called a hug? Of all metaphors, it's called a hug. And we do see it both in the Gemara too. For example, the Gemara Brachas Sukkah, in Daf Chav Zayin says that Kol Yisrael Ruya Leishiv B'Sukkot. You can bring all of Klal Yisrael metaphorically under one roof of the sukkah, which is interesting because Jews historically don't really get along very well. How could we all fit in one sukkah? How are we going to get along with the other people in the sukkah? there's a story where a young man became a rav, and he was rather untested. And the first week he got there, they said, Slichas, in the middle of Yitzris on Shabbos. And it erupted a commotion in the synagogue, in the shul, whether we do sit, whether to stand by this liturgy or whether to sit by the liturgy. So half of the crowd, the congregation got up, and half of them sat. And those that were sitting started screaming, our minhag over here, the way we, protocol is we sit. And the standing one said, no, you're ignoramuses, you're amaratzim. Here, the protocol is, we stand. And there was a big fight, and they didn't know what to do. So they go running up to this young rabbi, and this young rabbi says, I don't know what to do. After davening, we'll try to resolve it. So everybody was screaming, the whole prayers. After davening, he said, look, let's go find the oldest person in the community. And ask him, what generations-wise, this is a community you've been living here for generations, what the old rabbi did, what the prior rabbi did. So they go and they find this old fellow in a nursing home, and his wits are perfectly about him. And he brings, a few people. So two of them say, our minig, our, we always stood. And the old man nods. And then the other people say, no, our protocol was to sit. And the old man nods. So the rabbi looks at him, he says, what was the protocol? He says, they're both right. The protocol was to argue their heads off. So, this is one congregation. How do we have Kol Yisrael B'Sukkah Echad? So I put to you a vart that from the Mittler Rebbe, he says a fascinating thought. What's the difference between a hug and a kiss? And he says a very fascinating thing. He says, a kiss is always eye to eye, face to face. Yishakeni minashikos piyu. You look at the other person. But he says a hug is always cheek to cheek. I hug you, but I look right past you. I don't see eye to eye with you, and I can still embrace you. In other words, you can hug that person who you don't agree with. It could be your father, your mother, your children. I can love you and not agree with you. So the secret of the sukkah, v'yamino techapkeini, it's called a hug, and kol yisrael riyam leishu b'sukkecha, we can sit in the sukkah with people we totally don't agree with, and we could still love them. Let me tell you a story. Somebody told me that the Satmar Rebbe, who was known for his rather, for being rather opinionated, for lack of a better word, having very strong opinions, a man came to him, and a fellow from Israel, and he was here for medical reasons. So the Satmar Rebbe said, what is your bill going to be? And he gave him a check, and he said, if you need more money, come back to me. He was fighting a particularly malignant disease, and success. After many treatments, etc., the man got better, and he came back to the Satmar Rebbe to thank him. So the Satmar Rebbe said, you're better? 100% sure. So he said, yes. So he started screaming at him. So then, how could you be such a tzioni? How could you be such a zai? So the man said, but you've helped me all along. So he says, yes, I helped you, and I strongly disagree with you. I can love you and still disagree with you. And I think that's a very powerful thought. And why is that? I think that's because it's recognizing kishem she'em partzufam. Just as there are no two people in the entire world who really look alike, even identical twins you can usually tell, so too there are no two people who think alike, the Gemara says, right? And that makes sense. And, you know, one of the reasons for this is in science there's something called as the butterfly theory. But this has been proven. They'll take 1,000 golf balls up to the top of a mountain and drop them. And out of the 1,000, no two will end up at the same place. And why is it? One falls off the mountain, a tiny gust of wind comes, blows it a little this way. So then the next step, it hits a rock on the other side, and then it keeps rolling. It hits the wrong side of the tree trunk. They'll take 1,000,000 golf, no two end up in the exact same place. Now, if that's a golf ball rolling down a mountain, what is life like when the teacher looked at this child this way? This one had a different friend. This one had a that friend. The mother liked this one better. The father treated the other one better. Financially, where they were growing up, it's an impossibility in the billions and billions of things that happens to us over the course of life, starting with every morning when we got up, if we banged our head, right? It's just an impossibility for two people to really see things exactly alike. And the Gemara respects that and appreciates that. So we can be totally different and still hug each other. And that's the avodah of sukkahs. Going into a sukkah with somebody you totally don't agree with and having a beautiful sukkah meal and putting the disagreements aside, not mentioning them during the meal. And you know when we say that? We say during the Hoshanas, you say, Haruga Alecha. Klal Yisrael has had so many difficulties. So many have been killed. V'nechsheves kitzon tifcha, taken out to slaughter. Zruya bein machiseh, scattered among orphaned, many times hostile areas. Right? Does Klal Yisrael appreciate this or want this? Or see eye to eye with Kaviyachal on this, with God on this? Of course we don't. We don't understand it. But what does it say afterwards? Chavukabach. And yet, we hug you and embrace you. We totally don't agree. We don't understand. But there's still endless love. Chavuka dvukabach. So that is really the job of sukkah. Sukkah is a time when the family comes together. And who really gets along with that brother-in-law, sister-in-law, etc.? I mean, we know what families are like. But chavuka dvukabach. I can disagree with you. And let's agree to disagree and put that on the side. And in the sukkah, we hug and embrace and just love each other madly. It's just a time we dance and we say, we can be different and disagree. Chavuka udvuka bach. So let's, and I took the interview with Rabbi Bleich. It was a little bit long, and I cut it into more sound bites to make it a little more, you know, just easier to, you know, to digest. He's a big guy, and he speaks, you know, fantastic, you know, just King's English. So the first question was to discuss, you know, Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky and Reb Malkiel Kotler recently came out with a psak that every school has to be willing to accept boys even if they're unvaccinated. And they put forth that the, you know, the risk is extremely minimal and there's no real danger and we have to respect parents' rights. So let's hear what Rabbi Bleich, the great Paisik, has to say about this. Remember, he's the America's number one halachic ethicist and most knowledgeable in halachic halacha of medicine. That's fascinating to hear this, his commentary. The point would be those who would disagree would say as follows. They would say that there are medical doctors, be it a minority opinion, who believe it's dangerous to inoculate. And in the all the prior cases, there is no minority that says that it's dangerous. And he has a right to, a parent has a right to say, I accept the minority opinion. That's point one they make. And the other point is, according to the Center of Disease Control, there were 200 cases out of 300 million Americans last year where the lack of inoculation caused disease. So it's a shash that is so rachik that they say, well, you're not really making much of a difference. It's just so remote. Those are the two points that they would respond.
They're both based upon factual error. Let me start with the first. Number one, the point that there is danger in any procedure is absolutely correct. The Ramban, the Teres Otam, says, "Ein l'chosam shemarapel l'zeh, shein ha'memis l'zeh." Medicines are by definition potent. If they wouldn't be potent, they wouldn't do anybody any good. And there is the attendant danger that they can do harm. That doesn't mean that one shouldn't take medicine when one is sick. The issue, and we can talk about it later if we have enough time, what constitutes the threshold of a danger that has to be taken into account, into consideration. When we're talking about vaccinations, we are certainly talking about things that can be dangerous. Question is, and what is the danger? It turns out that the danger is extremely minimal. Minimal to the point of being non-existent, and they've been grossly exaggerated. Let me also say before I try to amplify that comment that there is no respectable body of medical opinion that counsels against vaccination. Quoted was that we have so few of these cases that it's really chashash rochok and you don't have to really be concerned. And the answer to that is that it's a half-truth. It is true. And the fact that we have so few cases and certainly even fewer fatalities is precisely because we've had successful immunization campaigns. It's what in medicine they call the herd effect. You don't have to vaccinate 100% of all people in order to eliminate a disease. I am not an epidemiologist. I won't tell you how many you have to vaccinate. But when you get to a very, very high percentage, the others who are not vaccinated are not going to catch the disease because there's nobody to catch it from. If you don't have this type of mass vaccination, and there are a lot of people out there who have not been inoculated, if one of them gets it, then you have a larger pool of people who will contract it, and the people, the unvaccinated people, can spread it even to vaccinated people, because with most of these, there isn't a 100% immunization rate.
Okay, that was really very interesting when he says, no respectable medical body in the entire world has come out and said vaccinations are dangerous. Okay, let's go back to Rabbi Bleich, and he's now going to talk about, can a yeshiva refuse to accept the child who's unvaccinated? And let's hear what he has to say. So Rabbi Bleich, what would you say, does a yeshiva have the right to tell a child who's not vaccinated to say, we will not accept you?
The answer is very complicated, and I don't think it's an answer of one size fits all. It depends upon the circumstances. And it strikes me as a little bit odd. We live in a society in which many sectors of our community are very concerned about uniformity, suppressing individualism, and we have produced a community in which there is a great deal of conformity to accepted norms, even when that hasn't the vaguest thing to do with halacha. Things that are entirely social and of no importance whatsoever, at least standing alone. The color of a shirt or the color of a hat is as good example as any. On the other hand, I suffer from a disability. I'm an American. And the people who grew up in an American culture were exposed to notions of libertarianism, individualism, that society shouldn't try to dictate to people what they should or should not do. And here I find myself answering questions about communities that don't want to enforce a vaccination program, and I'm here saying that it probably should be enforced, even though I say at the very outset I would prefer not to enforce it. I would prefer to use whatever powers of moral persuasion are available to get conformity rather than trying to force people to compel. Now, we're dealing with technical areas of halacha, and they have to be carefully defined. We have a kind of a tension between principles that, if not contradictory, are certainly antagonistic. You've got Mamori Chazal that say there's also Lamed B'mokim Sakana. You can't place yourself in a place of danger even when the danger is remote. And then you have a concept of Shemer Psoim Hashem. The Rabbanu Shel Olam preserves people who rely on him, who don't ask too many questions. When do you apply one, and when do you apply the other? When can you say, I'll be a Baal Betochen, the Rabbanu Shel Olam will take care of me, and when do you have to take measures so that the Rabbanu Shel Olam won't kaviyochol be put to that kind of a trouble? Well, the concept of Shemer Psoim is first and foremost a societal concept. If people don't regard a given activity as being dangerous, then it's fairly safe to say that in terms of halacha, it's not usur. Unless, of course, it's something that Chazal prohibited because of Hashash Rochok. So that if you don't perceive the danger, as far as halacha is concerned, the danger doesn't exist. Let me give you an example. I am absolutely convinced that if you live in the city of New York and probably most other places, the greatest danger in getting a vaccination is the automobile or the taxi ride to the doctor's office. Far, far more dangerous than anything associated with the vaccination.
Let me just sum up. You believe that a parent does have an obligation to inoculate their child? And certainly the latest medical studies would they've come out even more with new studies that autism, et cetera, have been debunked. Mm-hmm. And additionally, you say that on as far as a school accepting a child, it's a tension between the parents should be doing the right thing, but on the other hand, you recognize the concept of individuality, and it would have to be judged on a case-by-case basis.
No, that's not quite what I said. Although I said that, but I think I said more than that. What I have said is that I think that a parent has an obligation to inoculate the child. I don't think that's a matter of Shemer Psoim, and you could say I don't want to rely on Shemer Psoim. I think the danger is virtually non-existent. It doesn't even rise to the danger of Shemer Psoim. I also think that it depends. I began much earlier by saying that there's some circumstances in which there's no danger that I have to inoculate against. If we were living someplace in which every child in the school, except one, is inoculated, I don't really think that anybody would be in a position to say that we insist that this 100th child be inoculated. Now, of course, I don't think that you can live in a society in which you can hide the fact that the child hasn't been inoculated, and you have to contend with the possibility that if one child opts out, then other children are going to opt out, and you can no longer piggyback on the herd effect. Where there is a valid herd effect, nobody needs an inoculation, as long as you keep it a secret from everybody else.
So Rabbi Black basically says that for those who think it's dangerous, he says the most dangerous part about getting a vaccination is getting into your car and driving to the doctor. And additionally, he says that there would probably not be a concept of Shema Psayim Hashem here, because it's just not accepted anywhere in the United States to do this. So since it doesn't fall under the normal rubric of human behavior, so there would be no Shema Psayim Hashem. But on the other hand, it's because of the herd mentality, if your kid is the only kid, I guess he would be safe because there's nobody to catch it from. But what happens when many people start doing it? If a yeshiva gets known that their policy is, Rabbi seems to say that would be very problematic. And the yeshiva would have at that point the right to say, depending on how many, but if they knew that it was a number, they would have the right to say that we do not want to accept you. So we do have a differing opinion between Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, the great Rav Shiva of Philadelphia, and Rav Shiva of Lakewood, Rav Melchior Kotler, and the great medical ethicist and Talmud Chacham, the big Gaon, Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich. That's very interesting. So let's go on to our next. This is probably something that needs further, you know, we have to get Rabbi Bleich back, maybe some further clarification, maybe one or two other Rabbanim. I'm upset that I didn't have the sense to ask this to Rabbi Weiss when I had him here. That was really sad. So, but let's go on to, we have the great honor of having Reb Usher Weiss, the Goyen, the Kleisenberg, the Goyen, the Bauman Chas Usher, which is used worldwide. And let's go to our next interview. So I would like to ask the Rav that a very common issue today in Batei Dinim is establishing paternity through DNA. And I would like to ask the Rav his opinion on this matter.
Yes, if we deal with Shilas, the cutting edge of technology, this is a very relevant one. And the question of the significance of DNA testing affects Yeredeya, Evan Ezra, Choshe Mishpot, very many different areas. Choshe Mishpot, questions of Yerusha, when we want to determine whether Pliny is the son of Almighty. In Evan Ezra, claims for Mizainus, Mamzeris, Kohuna, Yeredeya, those are the most common shalas in Israel regarding the burial of soldiers that were killed in combat, and sometimes to our dismay they cannot be identified by their facial features, and the only way to identify them is with DNA.
Like 9/11, we had the issue in America too.
Right. Agonis. Yeah. And Agonis, I wrote a few chuvas about Agonis in 9/11, and then in the tsunami in the Far East, I was once again asked Shilas regarding Agonis. Recently, I had a question of a Kohen who was in a difficult personal situation, and he was introduced to a Gerusha, and he wasn't really aware of Dine Kahuna. We're dealing with a person that was in the first stages of tshuva, and he wanted to marry a Grusha. And his mother confided to him that he and his brother are not biological children of their father, the Kohen, but rather they were born by a sperm donation. He was shocked, the son, and they tested DNA, which verified that they are not the sons of their father. And the question is, would that be sufficient to be matia them, him, to marry the Grusha, and would it disqualify them from Cheskas Kohuna?
But the question is, how could it not be sufficient? That's the question, in my eyes.
Okay. I like you a great deal, but
no, according to the FBI, it's, I think, one in a trillion chance of DNA being wrong.
Yes, so by halachic criteria, would we be conveya mamzeres according to DNA? Would we kill a person? Would it be sufficient by din and nefushes?
Well,
DNA testing. And how would we define halachically the question of DNA? And so let me give you my opinion.
But I don't understand the... Okay, go ahead. I don't understand the question, but go ahead.
I think the first source of a scientific methodology to determine whether a person is the son of another. Because in Chazal, we have Eidus, we have Rav, we have Chazaka. So the first source of some kind of a scientific examination is probably in Sefer Hasidim Simei Reish Lamed Beis, which is an interesting story. A person went to the Medina Siyam together with a slave, and his son was born after he left, and the slave said that he is a son, and so the Sefer Hasidim, when the father passed away, said they should take blood from both parties and dip a bone of the father into the blood if it would be Nivla. That is the Sefer Hasidim. And the Elio Rabin Simetov Kof Samaches asks from Bava Basra Nunches. Bava Basra Nunches, we find a story in the Gemara of Rav Banur. Person heard his wife saying that of the 10 children she has, only one is from her husband. Before his demise, he wrote in his will that he leaves all his estate and all his nechusim to his one son. And then his 10 sons argued, each of them said, I am that chosen one. Rav Benua said they should all go up to the grave and bang on the grave until the father will get up and say, who is that son? 9 out of the 10 did so. One of them said, I'm not going to desecrate my father's memory. I'm not going to be mevaza him after his demise. Rabbi Benua said, that is the one that takes the entire Yerusha. So the Elia Rabbe says, so why didn't they do the methodology of the Sefer Hasidim? The Rashash in his Agoas and Bava Basra Nunches says, well, they were afraid. They didn't want to be kaveh mamzeres. And some present-day gedolim want to prove from the Rashash halacha that the scientific examination would be sufficient to be kaveh mamzeres. As a general comment, I don't think that is the derech in halacha. The Sefer Hasidim is a chiddush, like almost everything that's in Sefer Hasidim. But the kasha of the Elia Rabbe is not a kasha at all. Who says Rav Benua was aware of the Sefer Hasidim? And I don't even think that a shash meant to be koveya a halacha. All that a shash means to say is people might mistakenly think that this proves mamzeres, and therefore Rav Menua preferred not to use that methodology. The Tzitz Eliezer and some other gedolim, going back before DNA testing was available, but there was blood testing. And the Tzitz Eliezer argues that proving who a father is by blood tests negates Chazal. Because the Gemara Nidah Daf Lamed Aleph says that the father contributes loven and the mother contributes odem. So according to the Chazal, blood comes from the mother. How could a blood test determine who the father is? Once again, I tremendously admire the Tzitz Eliezer, but I think this is off mark. I don't think we could use Chazal, which isn't halachic criteria, to determine halacha. Ein lemeiden mepiagod as a big machloikis between the Shus Yankim and the Noi Debiud. Is it only when it's soyser halacha, or even if it's not soyser halacha? But we don't really know what Chazal mean. When Chazal say that the father gives loven, Chazal say that includes atzomois, gidon, tzipornayim, and the white of the eye. The mother gives the red, Chazal say that's or, bosor, saris, shachor shabayin. Chazal were definitely aware that every living creature has dam. That's a million places in Shas. Why don't Chazal mention Dam? So obviously Dam is excluded. And therefore I think that Gemara Nida is irrelevant to our question. The basic question is, how do we define DNA testing? Definitely isn't Eidus. Eidus is a very clear sugya. And the Rambam twice, interesting to point out, not in Hilchos Eidus, but twice in Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, Perek Zayin Halacha Zayin, Perek Ches Halacha Beis, the Rambam says, we believe Eidim not because we know. We are fully aware that there might be Eidei Sheker. Otherwise, it wouldn't appear in the Aseres HaDibros. Gzeres HaKosef. But many misinterpret the Rambam as if Eidus is not a Birur. It's the ultimate Birur. But it is a Birur because the Torah gives them Nemonas. What the Rambam means to say, it's not a Svora. Mitzad HaMetzias, we can never be confident that the Eidim are Eidim is. But that is the Din Torah. And the Din Torah is Nemonas. And Nemonas is the ultimate Birur. DNA testing either could fit into the Dinam of Umdana, even though I don't think it's Umdana. Umdana is what we define today as circumstantial evidence. The two most important sugis of Umdana are Bava Basra Tzadeh Gimel and Shavuos Lama Dalet. Bava Basra Tzadeh Gimel dealing with Dina Momenes. Gomel Oicha Ben Agmalim V'Nimtza Horig Bitzito. And we have to determine who killed that camel, probably the camel next to it. And that's a Machloikis Amero. Shavuos Lamed Aleph, the famous story of Reb Shimon Meshotach. He sees a person with a sword running after his friend. They run into a building. By the time he gets into the building, a person is grasping his last breaths, and the person holding the sword, Domoy Metaftef, and he says, Rosha, I know that you killed him, but I don't have any aid. Obviously proving that Umdana is not sufficient for Dina Nefoshes. However, Tosfos is a minority opinion, but Tosfos in Shavuos Lamed Daled says, Umdana Demuchach is relevant even by Nefoshes. What would be more Umdana Demuchach than the story of Shimon ben Shotach? According to Tosfos, there is always a theoretical possibility that the dying person snatched the sword out of the hands of his assailant, killed himself, and then the assailant picked up the sword. Very unlikely, very unreasonable, but a theoretical possibility. What would top that Umdana? Noshuch Begaboy. One person chases the other into a room, and he has simonim of a bite on his back. Well, a person cannot bite his own back. That is not only unreasonable, it is impossible. That grammar would be sufficient even, that umdana would be sufficient for nefoshes. But that goes against the Rambam. The Rambam says, no kivitzadek al tarog, this exeus akosa, we're not da nefoshes al pi umdana. I don't think DNA testing is umdana. Umdana is circumstantial evidence. DNA testing is like simonim. Siman Muvak. The principle of simonim is the total unreasonability that two objects will have exactly the same siman. And Chazal say siman muvak, nekev yesh betzad ois ployni is diuraisa. Machlokes shaching tzois and reish tzadik zayin, whether it is sufficient against cheskes momen. Shach Reish Tzadik Zayin Sif Kot Nalef maintains Moitzian Momen Al Pisim and Movek Diktzais doesn't think so. One Taisus in Shas Chulin Tzadik Vav Taisus argues Simen Movek would be sufficient for Dina Nefoshes, but that is Shelo Ali B'de Hilchus.
So can I ask you a question then? Let's say there would be Eidim negative Simen Movek, what's the Halacha?
That's a very good question. And it is almost brought up Lehedi in the Gemara in Eilu Metzias. Edechod against the Simen. Eidim against the Simen Muvak would be a good question. I think Eidim would override, because Edom are sufficient by everything.
So what would happen, halacha, DNA? Two Edom would say, we are 100% sure that this is not Beryl, and the DNA from the corpse, from the body, from the vehicle says, it's Beryl's DNA. What would you paskin?
Did you ever hear of the name Yoshe Kalb? Yoshe Kalb was a very famous story in Europe going back more than 100 years in the days of the Beis Halevi and the Shinavarov. It is known that the Shinavarov went to Brisk and the Beis Halevi received him with great covet. People don't know what is the background. Why did the Shinavarov, the son of the Divrei Chaim, go to Brisk? It was a weird story.
I think Shalshelas the Beis Halevi, Rishon LeShalshelas Brisk brings this story.
It was a weird story. A person named Yoshe Kalb vanished into thin air. After his wife was an aguna, and the Shinavarov gave her a heter to remarry, which she did not do. Suddenly, Yoshe Kalb is back in town. All the kids, everybody recognizes him. A big commotion, Yoshe Kalb is back. But when he was confronted, he said he never heard of the name Yoshe Kalb. And he had a real good alibi. He knew what his name is, where he comes from. He had a totally different story, but everybody was confident this is Yoshe Kalb. And some tshuvas were written about this crazy story. So the Shinavarov was so disturbed, he gave his wife a heter to remarry. And that brought him to Brisk, because the new Yoshe Kalb argued that he comes from Brisk. And the Shinavarov himself went to Brisk to research. At the end of the day, he asked that lady not to remarry. And he promised her arichas yomim. And she lived to be more than 100 years old. She never remarried. But coming back, you know, I'm not here to tell interesting stories. Coming back to our discussion, I think the DNA testing would be considered a siman muvak. Siman muvak would be sufficient for everything besides Dine Nefoshes.
Would override Edom then or not? In the case of this being matter, this Isha?
I don't think it would override Edom. Edom override anything else. The only thing that overrides Edom is defined in Yevamos Peches.
Bo Horog Baraglav.
And I don't know whether you're aware of the Yerushalmi. It's Cholak on the Bavli. The end of Kiddushin Daf Mem Zayin.
But can I ask the Rav, in my humble opinion, when the FBI says that something is one in a trillion, or it could be one in 10 billion, it's just a mathematical impossibility. Like Taisfis says on Yevamos Peches, Asa Gavra, Taisfis says that something that's gully via dua lakoil is stronger than Edom. If the man comes back into town and the Edom say, I'm sorry, you're dead. The Edom could say, I'm sorry, you're dead from today to tomorrow. Are we supposed to believe the Edom or our own lying eyes? We talk to him, we say, it's Beryl. Hi, Beryl, how are you? I went to the grocery. Yeah, we learned in yeshiva together. I remember the Taisfis we learned together. So Taisfis says, Gully via Dua is stronger than Edom. Wouldn't one in a trillion be stronger than Gully via Dua, Lakel?
Yes. I don't know where you're getting numbers. I don't think it's one in a trillion, but
Let's assume it would be one in five billion.
You know, before I answer your question, I want to strengthen it and substantiate it.
Okay.
The Toisis you're quoting is, I don't think the Russian is Golovia Dia, but Toisis deals precisely with the situation of Bohorek Baraglav. And Taisa's question is Trei Kameya. What does Bohorek Baraglav mean? Many people, but Trei Kameya. So Taisa says, the consent of the entire tzibur is not Edus, it is beyond Edus. That is what Chazal defines as Bohorek Baraglav. But that is Yedi'ah Bilti Emtza'it. That is what everybody sees. But I want to substantiate your question from a Gemara in Ksubis Ted Zayin. Kol Anises Besula, Yoitzes Behinuma. So Tosfos asks, if kol hanisas besu leyoytzes behinua, if eidim contradict that, they are eidei sheker. So that Gemara proves an unbelievable assumption that sometimes even a chazuka would disqualify eidim, and we would assume they are eidei sheker because they go against the chazuka. But this brings us back to the question, how do we define simonim and DNA? And this is the area in which I want to voice my opinion and a few points why my psak is that DNA will not decree in Hilchas Mamzeros. We do not paskin that a person is a mamzer based on DNA. Number one, there is only one source that Semen Muvik would be sufficient for Dina Nefoshes, and that is Tosfos Chulin Sedek Vav Ein Halacha Kemoisei. It's a major machlokes in Achronim, as I quoted before, where the Semen Muvik would be sufficient Lahoitzi Mecheskes Momen, going against the Muchzak. Rebbe Kiva Ege maintains in Semen Kufin the Tshuvis, Mamzeres Kedina Nefoshes Dami, and therefore Ein Mekablen Eidus Shaloi Befonov. We find many sources in Achronim how to what extreme we should go not to passel a person in Mamzeres. But Rebbe Kiva Ege's expression is Mamzeres has a din of Dina Nefoshes. And what isn't sufficient for Dina Nefoshes wouldn't be deficient for sufficient for Eides. Kedushin Ayin Gimel. There's a gzeres akos of mamzer vada yosra toira velo mamzer sofik. And the Shev Shemaitze, Shemaitze Alef, Perek Alef, has a lengthy discussion with the Pnei Yeshua and the Maharit. Many achroinim maintaining, even Rav, even though we go busarov, it's a diuraisa, even by nafoshes, but Rav is still defined as sofik, and therefore Rav is not sufficient to pasal a person b'mamzeres.
Yeah, but this is not a roiv. This is the metzias. This is the fact. This is beryl. When the corpse is here and they take the DNA and they define it and it's one in a trillion, this is beryl. This is not a roiv. It's not a chazaka. It's better than baharug baragalov, because the harug could be misidentified. No, this is the fact. It's like daylight outside.
I think that's a total mistake. Halacha criteria is different. I don't mean to say that's roiv. What I mean to say is the gzera sakosuv of mamza vaday osra toira velo mamza sofek overrides dinim diuraisa. Roiv is sufficient, and it's gzera sakosuv daslinam bosa roiv. Af al piken, the Achroinim maintain, regarding the Gzeres HaKosov of Mamza Vadeh Veloy Mamza Sofek, Roiv is defined as a Sofek. By halachic criteria, it's not defined as a Sofek, at least not in the Koyach of Roiv. Sofek Brochas Lakola, but not in the case of Roiv. In the din of Mamza Vadeh Veloy Mamza Sofek, Rav would not be sufficient. I do not mean to say that DNA is defined as roiv. The only thing that is vadai regarding Dina Mamzeres is one of the two, Eidus or Bo Horeg Baraglav.
Why isn't this the equivalent to Bo Horeg Baraglav, or it even is, better?
Bo Horeg Baraglav is only something that is natural. Re'ias Einayim. Not scientific knowledge.
Well, scientific Re'ias Einayim.
I totally disagree. Scientific is knowledge. It is not Re'ias Einayim.
Well, they do it under a microscope. They
don't see Beryl's face on the microscope. This is scientific knowledge. That is not Bo Horeg Baraglav, in my opinion. Either testimony or Bo Horeg Baraglav. Halachic criteria is not based on the degree of our knowledge. And I think the Rambam makes that point very clear. If we have to rate Eidus against Simen Muvak, Simen Muvak would override Eidus. if we would do statistic screening, we would come to the conclusion that 1 out of 100 ate him as an eight checker. 1 out of 200 ate him as an eight checker. Simenovic should definitely override Adam if that would be our approach. But Simenovic is not sufficient for Dina Nefoshes, and Eidus are. Because by halachic criteria, it is not numbers. That is the din of Eidus. And the only thing that overrides Eidus is Yediyah Bilti Emtzait, which is Bohor Beraglav. It is what you see. Scientific testing is not Yediyah Bilti Emtzait. It is based on scientific equations, on mathematics, that is not Bohor Beraglav. But Levi, let me move on and make an additional comment. I know to some people this would seem queer, but to me, not at all. The nature of science is such, many assumptions at the time, they were undisputable. And then comes a later generation and understands scientific reality in a totally different way. I know that it seems very unlikely regarding DNA testing. But at the time, it seemed very unlikely to assume that the world is round. And as recent as 300 years ago, the Shfus Yankov writes, how could we trust doctors if they think the world is round? And we can give many examples of basic scientific knowledge and scientific assumptions which were ironclad and concrete at their time, and then a later generation understood more than the previous ones did, and scientific truths are shifting sand. Does that mean we won't rely on science? No, we definitely would. Going back to Chazal, we find in Nidachov Beis, Chazal consulted doctors regarding Hilchas Nid and relied on doctors. Shabbos Peivov, Chazal say regarding Dinei Kel Ayim, and understanding agriculture, they consulted the mumchim. So al pi halacha, we definitely rely on scientists, on doctors, on mumchim.
So are you suggesting...
I think we should differentiate between shailas that are nagaya kan v'achshav, here and now, whether this woman is a nidah or not, whether this is kalayim or not, we rely on present-day scientific knowledge. When we're dealing with mamzeres, and what we paskin today will affect future generations, we will not rely on pure scientific criteria, which might change. And as unlikely it would seem now that this could ever change, you can never know.
It's
in
true,
science,
but...
in science, everything could change, and therefore... Mamzeres, in my eyes, is different than any other shaila. Mamzeres is puzzling future generations, and therefore we cannot do that based on scientific criteria.
So would you be mechalik then between Mamzeres and being mater and aguna if two Adam came and they said... So you would be mater the aguna, but Mamzeres you'd be...
Yes, I would be mater the aguna on DNA testing, even though we try to...
In place of if Adam were against it.
I wish to steer clear from the dilemma you keep on bringing up, Adam against Simon Muvak. That is an interesting discussion. I would rely on DNA testing to be mater and aguna, not to passel a person in Mamzeres. Two more arguments. One is human error. And we know that it is always possible, human error. So regarding testimony, that is Gezeiras HaKosef. Anybody that has dealt with doctors and laboratories knows that there is a margin of human error. DNA is unquestionable, at least by scientific criteria today, but there is always the margin of human error which needs to be taken into account, and therefore we cannot pass on a person among us. an additional argument, and I bring up five or six arguments because it is our task to be as careful as possible dealing with mamzeres. You can only apostate a person with mamzeres with proper edim. The laboratory technicians aren't kosher le'edus. The clerk giving over the information isn't kosher le'edus. So even though the actual testing, if we assume it's foolproof, but there are different stages in which we have no edus kshera, and therefore, how do we know? How do we know?
We could have religious doctors doing the slides, etc.
Are we mechuyev to do that to passel a person? No. Definitely not. Okay, so therefore we won't passel a person in mamzeres according to DNA testing, and we're not mechuyev. To the contrary, we're not mechuyev to have to train from technicians and from doctors and from clerks for what, to passel a person? No. That is not halachic criteria. So this is an additional reason I would not passel a person by mamzeres based on DNA. And last, it's a gadata, but it's interesting, and it might have significance. There's an amazing medrash in Parshas Nosoi, Perek Tes. The medrash says, when a woman is mezana, and she has a baby, an Eishes Ish, and the baby is from her husband, not from that other person, a Ben Belial. A Kodesh Bochu Tzor Ponov, Kipnei Haboyel, Lohodia Keloinoi Berabim. Interesting, but it's a Medish. What we learn from this Medish, sometimes a Kodesh Bochu tosses up nature and genetics. Kedei, as unlikely as it might seem, the face of a baby should be the face of the sperm from which he came. So this is an interesting medrash. And if a Kodesh Baruch Hu plays around with genetics, he might be playing around with DNA testing as well. So according to this medrash, an additional reason why we won't pass on another b'mamzeres. However, regarding the question with which we started our discussion about that kohen, yes, I think it disqualifies him from kehena, DNA testing. I also have an interesting argument regarding the Shev Shemaitze, and I think it's a big yesoid lekula. Shev Shemaitze, Shemaitze Vov, Perek Tes Vov argues, the passel a person, he need two edim. And therefore, to be mayed that a person is a cholel, you need two edim. I argue, you only need two edim because the chazaka of a person on his rights as a kohen to duchen, pidyon ben, his right to Kedushas Kohana is no less than Cheskas Momen. After he is disqualified from Kehuna, you don't need to aid him to be mater him to marry a Grusha or a Gyoris. And if we say DNA testing would disqualify him from Kehuna, then you no longer need to aid him to be mater him to marry a Gyoris. And because I think if DNA proves he is not his father's son, he cannot go on duchening, that would also be sufficient to enable him to marry that grusha, and that was my psak in that case. So I would rely on DNA testing regarding agunis, regarding yerusha, regarding dinamominis, excluding mamzeres for the many reasons I explained, and I think that mamzeres is on the level of Dina Nefoshes.
Well, even when the Rebbe Kivegis says that Dina Nefoshes, I don't know if he means that it has the same Dina of Haggadah's Eidus of Dina Nefoshes, or it has the same Chomer of Dina Nefoshes.
He is dealing with Haggadah's Eidus. He is dealing with Kabbalah's Eidus, right. Shaloi Befonov. He doesn't deal with other aspects. But, you know, there's a Medrash. Dima Sashukim She'en La Menachem, that is Medrash. Mu'uvis Lo Yuchel Etak, and that is Mamzeres. We do find in Chazal that were maflig b'chumras u'inyan of mamzeis.
Thank you.
We should always be zoicha lahagdol Torah u'ladira. This is a tremendous challenge to Paskin Shilas in a changing world in which we have tremendous dilemmas. And we have to start every day and end every day with a tefillah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu shaloi nekosh el bedvar halacha. And we should always be zoicha lahagdol Torah u'ladira u'lekadosh Shem Shamayim.
Amen. Well, I'd like to conclude. It was really an amazing session we had today, two of the biggest Gainim in the world. And I'd like to just conclude again with a little bit of a Torah thought, a Mashava. We just passed Yom Kippur. And many people ask, why is like the highlight, one of the two three highlights of Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre? Everybody gets together and they take out the Sifrei Torah, they open the Ark, and what do they say? May all our vows, our charamim, our nedarim, may they be annulled. I mean, it's very controversial, you know, that in Germany they took it out because people thought it meant that you could swear in court and not mean what you say. But what is the intent? And I put to you, you know what the intent is and why we start Kol Nidre like that? You know, there's an old aphorism, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never harm me. You know what? You could say you heard it here. It's a lie. Your chances of being hurt by words are a million times greater than being mugged. Those mean words somebody said to you years ago, they still hurt you today. Admit it. So what is it? Words are powerful, and words create chains. So how do we start the Yom Tov? We want to move forward. What's Yom Kippur? It's about a new year. It's about letting go. It's moving on. Breakthrough to that new year. You know what we say? All those words that I said to myself, you can't, you shouldn't, you're not good enough, it's not for you, you're not smart enough, you can't break through. All those can'ts, they're like chains, let them break. Let me break through to the new me, the new year. Let me throw it all behind. Let my Kabbalah la'asid, the narrative of my tomorrow, be unrestrained. So the somber moment of Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre, all the vows, the promises, the charamim, everything, all that, every time I heard you can't and I said you can't, they're gone. Let's break through, you, me, to what we want to have, a fantastic, productive, amazing Shana Tayvo Masuka. I'll speak to you next week. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines.